A slightly different order than is in the program. We're going to start with Michael Peters talking about community engagement and sustainable living, concepts, practices, challenges, and opportunities. And then go in order. This talk will set the context for the other papers well. So let me just give us a minute to settle down. And what we are going to do is take the four presentations and then have our discussion so we can talk about them all together a little bit. And of course, we can also talk about particular papers, individual papers in the discussion. So without further ado, let me turn it over to Michael. Thank you.
Okay, so what I'd like to do is to outline some of the community engagement work that we've been carrying out within the policy and governance theme of Resolve, and to give you a few research highlights and findings that are relevant to this whole idea of collective action in promotion of sustainable living. The basic premise upon which this work is based is around the idea that the climate challenge is above all a challenge for governance. As we all know, fossil fuels have for two centuries or more been the invisible currency of everyday living. How we live, work, get around, invest our money, spend our leisure time, all depend on access to high-quality energy sources, and that in its turn has meant primarily dependency on the consumption of fossil fuels. And weaning ourselves off fossil fuel dependency is much more than just a technological task. It calls on society to untangle the structures of provision and build new, more sustainable practices, infrastructures, and forms of social organisation. And governance is very much key to this endeavour. Good governance requires an informed citizenry who are much more than just consumers and customers, but are active participants in what you might call a new post-carbon politics. The reality is that governance itself becomes stretched by the demands of climate change. It must reach upwards to the world stage, downwards to the regions, communities, and households. Global initiatives must resonate at the local level. Global targets must mean something to households. And there we have one of the first challenges in that long-term targets, particularly if you think of 2050, to your average householder, it's a very long way off. Targets are movable, they can be unreliable, and unless they are met, can become a source of scepticism and lost hope. Where there is perhaps an element of merit with regard to targets is in their ability to focus minds on a particular issue or common threat and motivate action to address it. And local level action has a vital role to play in the transition to a more sustainable low carbon economy. This recognition that top-down administrative approaches can only go some way in bridging the complex relationship between citizens, institutions, and policy delivery mechanisms has been borne out in several recent official policy documents and legislation, in particular the latest energy white paper, the Low Carbon Transition Plan, and then, of course, most recently, the Big Society Agenda and Localism Agenda. And this has gone hand in hand with a growing status for local authorities and their role as a vanguard of local and community action on climate change. In fact, the Low Carbon Transition Plan, which states here that people should increasingly be able to look to their local authority not only to provide established services but also to coordinate, tailor and drive the development of a low carbon economy in their area, exemplifying this growing status and role for local authorities as a much more central part of national government thinking. So then we come to the question really of why community, and community efforts to cut carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases hold the potential to benefit from greater emphasis on collective expediency, with the idea of accomplishing more by acting together rather than alone, and with broader motivational impacts in terms of encouraging positive beliefs and actions. We should also recognise the salience of underlying concepts that can shape and influence the extent to which a programme of engagement or intervention is likely to be successful. So in addition to the environmental advantages of some of these different community engagement interventions, the communities themselves can benefit from and contribute to the bolstering of social capital, promoting the ways in which information is processed in society, in other words, social learning, and triggering the establishment of new social norms. So in the early days of Resolve, the work focused on reviewing conceptual understandings of communities and social change, drawing particularly on insights from the sociological literature. And this work illuminates several key issues that I would like to just put across. Firstly, it's apparent that society is decreasingly made up of integrated, geographically based communities in the way that it once was, and is increasingly made up of numerous diverse communities, communities which often overlap and sometimes exist in complete isolation from one another. And one person may well engage in several different communities at the same time. The point of that is that no one approach or project is necessarily going to reach the community and by extension the issues within it. A diversity of tools and approaches is required. That's absolutely clear. Social learning theory, going back to that, highlights the fact that we continually model our behaviour on the behaviour of others, subconsciously and consciously, aligning our actions to what we respect and desire to be like and veering away from anti-role models. So connecting with a broad spectrum of community members in the adoption of pro-environmental behaviour is likely to increase the number of role models and potentially enhance the desirability of adoption amongst larger numbers of community members. The work that we then progressed on to, empirical work, attempted to capture the perspective of decision makers responsible for establishing different types of community engagement initiative, but also to capture the citizen, the participant and non-participant perspective. So we carried out a range of work that involved surveys, focus groups, semi-structured interviews with decision makers of local authorities and non-state community interventions. What I'd like to do is to highlight some of the core messages that arose from the interviews we carried out with local government decision makers in their attempts to promote sustainable living and the adoption of more environmentally responsible practices in amongst their communities. The work highlights some of the opportunities and challenges faced by local government in these efforts. First of all, there's the great potential for local government as a facilitator in raising awareness of the worthwhile collective contribution to tackling climate change that individuals can contribute to. So, for example, a direct quote from one of the participants: "We have a real chance through our climate change months," which was a project in Shropshire County, in the county of Shropshire, to get the message across that everyone's effort counts, and that that recognition of collective expediency is vital. The ability to utilise and tap into existing community groups and networks was another key area of opportunity that was highlighted. linking up, for example, with groups like the Women's Institute, parish councils and young people's forums, and I'll come back to that at the end. And also a chance to capitalise on these latent concerns about climate change, a feeling that there is perhaps an increasing number of people who are beginning to take on board the seriousness of environmental issues and particularly the threat of climate change, but still a lack of knowledge on what practically to do about it. The challenges are quite problematic, really, for local government to overcome, but recognition of challenge is probably the first step in making progress towards ameliorating those problems. Firstly, and majorly, getting people to participate, an enormous problem, and the fact that for many of these initiatives, they tend to attract people who are already routinely engaged in pro-environmental routines and habits. Disinterest and apathy regarding the individual contribution is another potential problem. So the opportunities and the challenges, in a way, are two sides of the same coin. And the fact that people do lead hectic lifestyles and have other priorities. For example, people's perception of time and how busy they are and how much they are preoccupied with different issues is a massive barrier. And we also found that even for local authorities who are committed to community engagement as a core focus for their climate change agendas, problems of poor image and perception in the community associated historically with low levels of trust stand to threaten the progress and success of those locally focused initiatives. So taken together, these findings point to potential difficulties on relying too strongly on local authorities as change agents in addressing the more intractable problems of sustainable development. The participant perspective, just to give you an overview of that from this one particular piece of work that we did with visitors and residents in the broader community of Islington, where they established this Green Living Centre, which provided advice around four main areas for local residents in the community: recycling, energy efficiency, biodiversity, and green travel. Respondents to the visitor survey were asked how they became aware of the centre's existence, and this elicited a range of responses, but most notably, happened to notice it when walking down the street, and word of mouth, which indicates perhaps that spontaneous impulsion, owing to the position of the centre in a busy high street, may prove most effective in engendering broader interest and visits of this to this type of initiative than the official awareness raising by the local authority. In terms of perceived usefulness, the visitor sample responded, on the whole, very or quite helpful, and a similar outlook revealed to the question of what extent they felt it might have an impact in encouraging community members more broadly to adopt sustainable lifestyles and practices. This contrasts markedly with the results from the work with the broader community, where awareness was much more mixed. For example, over half of the people had never heard of it. And a level of disinterest that was revealed in this type of initiative in non-response to answers to the question of wanting to find out more. So, okay, you have 30.8% of those people who want to find out more. There's a massive part of the sample who didn't respond to that question. So potential disinterest in that kind of initiative. Reaching the broader community, we noticed that although, yes, this type of initiative does tend to attract people who are routinely engaged in pro-environmental habits, so too were many of the broader survey, the people in the community who haven't visited the centre and perhaps don't have any intention to do so. So in other words, this type of initiative isn't the litmus test of whether you have a sustainable community. There are sustainable things going on elsewhere. And in fact, as I say, a vast proportion of the non-visitors reported to be engaged in a range of behaviours like 89% recycle regularly, 84% trying to waste less food, and 75% walking or cycling more. So we have this juxtaposition. We have initiatives that are attracting a certain section of society. We have another broader section of society that it seems almost impossible to reach and influence. So for that reason, the last piece of work that I just want to briefly outline has been looking at other types of community groups and networks. We wanted to look at groups that have large memberships, that have a range of purpose and activity, and that are well established. We wanted a range of member types in terms of the social demographics of the people who participate and different community roles. And in particular, groups, established groups, for whom environmental issues and sustainable living aren't the main priority. So these were broken down into workshops, focus group style workshop work with key informants from the Women's Institute. That was one group on its own. We had a youth groups workshop, which included leaders from the Surrey Youth Development Services, schools, Duke of Edinburgh, the uniformed organisations, a members group with representation from groups like the Rotary Club, parish councils and town societies, and then a faith groups with different faiths represented, Sikh, Jewish, Muslim and Christian denominations. And then as a proxy for a sort of control group, we did also the same thing with conservation groups, including Greening Campaign representatives, British Trust for Conservation volunteers and environmental forums. One of the wonderful things about these types of voluntary organisations and community groups is that they add a texture of diversity to the fabric of society. But with that diversity comes the challenge of connecting with a vast range of values, desires and priorities. And in many ways, this reflects in microcosm the wider challenge of community engagement in society as a whole. Where there's perhaps greater potential with these types of groups is in their existing sense of collective purpose, shared values and drive. The question is how that might be harnessed in the promotion of sustainable living and collective action. So for youth groups, for example, as a whole, the key message that came across in relation to motivating young people is to make the issue manageable, breaking actions down into small, manageable chunks, providing rewards for progress achieved, and recognising that for particularly younger age groups, issues such as intergenerational equity might be a bridge too far. As this participant said, it's a lot for that particular age group to take on emotionally. Faith groups, an entirely different set of responses and an entirely different meaning in terms of the relevance of climate change. But two things in particular. One, the message and the purpose of acting on climate change was aligned very closely to the key tenets of the different faiths represented. So that's one reason. And then this idea about a ministry of encouragement and being able to provide a podium for inspirational speakers with the authority that leadership in religions can give to the message. So finally, because I've had to skip a little bit of that, the work highlights really the promise and the limitations. On the one hand, a meaningful way to achieve global targets and an avenue for renewing social relations at the community level. On the other hand, it challenges fundamental aspects of social organisation, and this potential to achieve effective community engagement isn't straightforward, partly because of the eclectic nature of communities, the diversity of lifestyles in the community, and partly because of the existence of wider constraints on community action. In the final analysis, though, communities come in many forms, a mixture of policy tools and practical handles which people can identify with and then latch onto will be essential. And the common theme is that community activity and action, collective action on climate change at the local level, is about inclusivity. It is really the antithesis of isolation and individualism. So I'll leave it there. Yeah, thank you.
Now we have a lecture.